Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Season 3 of Dealing Justice. I'm Jennifer Dubisac.
And I'm Lori Jennings.
In today's episode, we're shuffling the deck and spotlighting the solved case of Florida man Mike Williams. This is part one of a two-part episode.
This is fascinating because you have a tight-knit group of four people who were best of friends and girlfriends and boyfriends in high school. They all eventually went to Florida State. They got married. They had kids within a few months of each other. And they were literally joined at the hip. And what the whole world didn't know was that murder was okay. A divorce was absolutely not.
Hear how justice was dealt for Mike Williams. We would love to see the day when there are no faces to put on the cold case playing cards. But until that day comes, we will continue telling these stories in pursuit of dealing justice.
It's time for us to solve these cases one card at a time.
This is Season 3, Episode 5, The Mike Williams Case, 10 of Clubs, Florida Deck. This episode of Dealing Justice brings us to Tallahassee, Florida, where the dignified facade of the state capitol becomes a chilling backdrop for a heinous murder that defies all sense of decorum. Jerry Michael Williams, known as Mike, grew up in Bradfordville, Florida, a town just north of Tallahassee. I'm very familiar with this part of Florida, having grown up just a couple of hours west in Panama City, Florida. Mike Williams went missing in December of 2000, but this case started well before then and continued long after. I remember this case and the shocking twists and turns and the cast of characters that seemed to come straight out of a Hollywood script. One of those characters was Mike's mom, Cheryl Williams. I spoke with Cheryl in depth about Mike's story, which really became just as much her story. She did not wish to have her voice recorded, but she gave us her blessing in telling this story. In addition, she also provided someone to be her surrogate voice.
Steve Epstein, an attorney and best-selling true crime author, met Cheryl while writing about Mike's case. His book, Evil at Lake Seminole, is a captivating read that delves into the intricate details of this case and the heinous acts that would decimate the lives of so many innocent people. Much of the details we learned about Mike's story came from Cheryl's and Steve's interviews and Steve's book, Evil at Lake Seminole.
Okay. I'm Steve Epstein. I'm an attorney in Raleigh, North Carolina. I've been practicing law for about 34 years, and I have been a true crime author for about the last 7 years. I have three published books. The second one, the one that we're going to talk about, is Evil at Lake Seminole, which is about the disappearance and then, as we learned later, murder of Mike Williams, who was a Tallahassee resident who had a wife and a daughter and was on a duck hunting trip the day before his sixth wedding anniversary with his high school sweetheart. And so much of what I wrote about in the book relates to their supposed beliefs in Christianity and how rooted they were in everything related to the Bible, which is bizarre. Just bizarre that this plot was hatched amid all of this talk about Jesus and Christianity and how religious they were.
Tallahassee, Florida, and the smaller towns around it provide an interesting backdrop for this story. Tallahassee is the state capital of Florida, so it's a political hub, but it's also known for its two major universities, FAMU and Florida State University. It's an intriguing mix of politicians in suits, college kids in hoodies, and homegrown locals decked in camouflage, keeping the Bass Pro Shop in business.
And although Tallahassee is not technically considered a small town, it has way more southern small town vibes than big city, that's for sure. To be raised here means you understand the southern motto of God, family, and football, and have a healthy respect for the country life. In 1970, when Michael was born, the Williams family fit in here perfectly. They were a typical hardworking family that stayed grounded in the simple things in life.
Michael was named after his father, Jerry Michael Williams, who was a bus driver for Greyhound. His mom, Cheryl, ran a daycare out of the family home. And not just any daycare. Cheryl is considered a second mom to many of the kids who spent their formative years under her roof, being raised with the Williams boys. The Williams family was a staple in the community.
Both Mike and his brother Nick grew up with a healthy respect for family, hard work, and a love for the great outdoors. As a teenage boy, Mike discovered duck hunting, and through the years, this sport became his favorite pastime. He loved the outdoors and found solace in the woods, appreciating the peace of mind that came with being surrounded by nature. Just a guy alone in the woods with no pressures from the outside world.
They were a typical middle-class family, but instead of working towards a bigger home or fancier vacations, Cheryl and her husband prioritized education and their Christian values for both Michael and Nick. Despite their modest income, they found a way to send the boys to a small Christian private school called North Florida Christian High School in Tallahassee. Now again, North Florida is home to me, so there are nuances around this area that are so much a part of my DNA that I simply can't describe the area as good as an outsider would. Steve, on the other hand, does a pretty good job.
So for those who aren't familiar with Florida geography, Tallahassee is in the panhandle, which is just above the Gulf of Mexico. And so this part of Florida is really not Florida. It's really, so they say, I think, the further south you go in Florida, the further north you are. The further north you go, the further south you are. And so this is really more like southern Georgia or southern Alabama, where people do speak with very thick southern accents. And the way of life is, there's no palm trees. There's a lot of moss-covered oak trees. It's a very sweet iced tea, biscuits and gravy. I mean, it is traditional South Bible thumpers. And that all plays into this. This was not jet-setting Miami. This was a slow, lazy Tallahassee. Even though it's the state capital, it is a very strange place. And my Tallahassee friends that I've made over the years don't like people talking about Tallahassee like that. But compared to South Florida, which is what most people think of as Florida, it could not be more different. And the Baptist Church, just like it is in South Georgia and South Alabama, is huge in Tallahassee and surrounding areas. And the Baptist Church figures very prominently. In fact, they were at a Christian school. That's where all these relationships developed, was at North Florida Christian School.
Steve is right. This is the Bible Belt. What church you attend and how often you go dictates what social circles you run in. It tends to make life easier when your friend group knows the unspoken expectations of your family and your religious community. I'm sure that's how Mike must have felt while he attended North Florida Christian. By all accounts, he seemed to fit in and meet the expectations of both his peers and his teachers. Mike excelled both academically and socially. He was a football player, on student council, and worked part-time, yet he still managed to have a thriving social life.
His freshman year of high school, he met a girl named Denise Merrill. She was soft-spoken, thin, pretty blonde-haired girl, and it didn't take long for the two to fall head over heels in puppy love. They were the power couple of NFC High School. She was a cheerleader, on student council, in the homecoming court, and voted best dressed by her classmates. Mike was a star football player, president of the Key Club, and voted best personality. In Steve's book, Evil at Lake Seminole, these moments were documented with pictures throughout the book. They attended school dances and events together, and it was clear that Mike and Denise were part of the in crowd.
Freshman year was a game changer for Mike. Not only did he meet his girlfriend Denise, but he also met the kid who would become his best friend, Brian Winchester. Brian was friends with Denise. They had known each other since they were toddlers. They both attended Holy Comforter Private School until attending high school at NFC. Brian was outgoing and smart, and the three friends had so many things in common, but the thing they didn't share was an income bracket. Brian's family was wealthy and connected, but it never seemed to be an issue for the two friends. They enjoyed hunting trips and weekends on the lake water skiing on Brian's family's boat.
Eventually, Brian added a fourth to their cozy group. Kathy Aldridge was also a cheerleader at NFC, and she and Brian began dating their sophomore year. So Mike And Denise and Brian and Kathy became very close, and by the time they all graduated in 1988, the two pairs of high school sweethearts were as thick as thieves. Their bond only grew stronger throughout college as all four of them attended Florida State University in Tallahassee.
Florida State 52-17.
Mike majored in political science and urban planning, while Denise focused on accounting. Mike wasn't your typical college student. He rarely drank, never used foul language, and every Sunday he attended Parkway Baptist Church with Denise and her family. He was also incredibly frugal, saving every penny he could. During his college years, Mike met Clay Ketchum, a real estate appraiser who, along with his wife, ran Ketchum Appraisal. Mike needed a job, and Clay saw potential in him, hiring him and teaching him everything about the appraisal and real estate business.
Clay quickly realized that Mike was a quick study and a very hard worker. He became Mike's mentor, and in 1992, after graduation, he hired Mike as a full-time appraiser at Ketchum Appraisal. Clay held great respect for Mike, often describing him as the hardest working man he had ever saw, and someone who was straight as an arrow.
Denise, on the other hand, worked as an accountant for the state of Florida. Brian and Kathy also found their places in their parents' companies. Brian joined his father's financial planning firm, and Kathy worked at her parents' printing shop. The foursome was following the successful, conservative Southern playbook to a T.
Mike especially checked all the boxes. Squeaky clean through high school? Check. Get a degree from the hometown SEC college? Check. Attend church regularly? Check. Meet a conservative girl from an upstanding family? Check.
And the only box left to check was to get married and start a family. In December of 1994, Mike checked the marriage box too. Mike Williams and Denise Merrill were pronounced husband and wife at the Thomasville Road Baptist Church with an adoring audience of friends and family. Standing by their sides were their best friends, Brian and Kathy Winchester. Brian and Kathy had wed 6 months earlier, and now here they stood, witnessing their best friends, Mike and Denise, swear before God to have and hold, honor and obey, forsake all others until death do they part. And this was their solemn vow. And one of them actually meant it. But for now, it seemed the foursome had the world by the begonias. They were living a fairy tale, and they were just beginning chapter one.
The young couples were enjoying married life and each other's company. They continued their close friendships and enjoyed attending football games at their alma mater to cheer on the Seminoles, weekend trips, a ski trip to Colorado, movies, dancing, double dates at nice restaurants. I mean, why not? Mike and Denise, Brian and Kathy were all in their mid-20s, good-looking with steady careers and growing incomes. Mike was an all-star at work, and he showed no signs of letting up. He worked countless hours during the week and spent his weekends hunting and fishing. Brian's weekends were spent competing in water ski tournaments, cycling, and boating. And at work, he was doing great. Brian had taken, or maybe I should say was given, the torch and ran with it. He was making his clients money at his father's investment firm and also providing them insurance coverage. And he was a great salesman. In fact, he convinced Mike to up his life insurance coverage, telling him that that is what married men do. And to Mike, it made sense. So on February 2nd, 1995, Mike signed a life insurance policy for $250,000, sold by his best friend, Brian Winchester.
October 13th, 1997. 3 years into their storybook romance, Mike and Denise went to a concert for a popular 90s rock band with Brian and Kathy. According to Brian, he and Denise were left alone while Mike and Kathy parked the car, and something just sparked. The two made out while knowing their partners could walk up at any moment, but they didn't get caught. When the concert was over, they drove home, said goodnight, and went to their respective homes. However, after Kathy and Mike went to sleep, Denise and Brian had phone sex, and after that, there was no stopping that runaway train. Denise Williams began an affair with none other than Brian Winchester, Mike's best friend. The two couples had been inseparable for years, sharing countless memories and milestones together. Mike was, after all, the responsible one. at home and at work. He was fun, but Mike was also a workaholic. His parents afforded him a life they did not get to have, and he was not going to waste a moment of it. He had his life mapped out and saw work as his opportunity to create financial security for him and Denise. But Denise was enjoying her youth. She was raised in a strict religious home where drinking and partying was absolutely forbidden, and she was making up for lost time. Mike would often go to work long nights, leaving Denise to fill her time going to bars and concerts with Brian and Kathy. He was adjusting to the new Denise. After all, she still maintained her pious exterior around her family and church community, and he was fiercely protective of her. In fact, Mike treated Denise like the princess, and his coworkers would often joke that they all wanted to be married to Mike. Denise, according to others, played the princess part well. For example, in the book Evil at Lake Seminole, Stephen writes that Denise refused to pump her own gas. She would call Mike from the gas station when she needed gas. He would leave work to go pump her gas and then return back to work, often staying late to make up for any time he lost. But if Mike resented his high-maintenance wife, he didn't show it. He was a true Southern gentleman, and he loved taking care of people, including his mom, Cheryl. They were very close and spoke almost every single day. He was a busy man, but life was about to get a lot busier.
It's 1998, and both Brian and Kathy and Mike and Denise were expecting their first child. Mike was thrilled. It seemed to the outside world as if Mike and Denise's storybook romance had no villain to overcome. But in the midst of baby bliss, tragedy struck. Mike's dad, Jerry Williams, died after complications from a motorcycle accident. The family was devastated, but none more than Mike's mom, Cheryl. She was learning how to navigate life on her own, and Mike and his brother were her support system. And to ease her loneliness, Mike and Denise bought Cheryl a chocolate lab named Hershey. And before long, Cheryl had a new grandbaby to also keep her company. On May 8, 1999, Ansley Merrill Williams was born, exactly one day before Mother's Day, and the celebration was captured by a local news station.
We're just totally overwhelmed. She was due Tuesday, and she would have made me wait a whole other year for Mother's Day, so she came yesterday so I could enjoy this day today with her.
It was unbelievable. I have a whole new respect for my wife and women in general and what they go through to bring a new child, new life into the world.
Here's Steve Epstein.
So you get a feeling of Denise at that point in time, which is 19 months before the murder. And, you know, she comes across as this very demure, soft-spoken, afraid of her own shadow kind of person. And yet, based upon things that Mike shared with his boss, Clay Ketchum, she was doing drugs. She was going out to wild parties. And based upon Brian's description of what was going on, that they'd been having a three-year affair, having sex in the state capitol and all kinds of places, in elevators and, you know, just wild, wild, wild woman. But, you know, so basically living a double life.
Ansley's birth seemed to solidify the picture-perfect family image they portrayed to the outside world, masking the underlying strains and tensions that would soon unravel their lives.
Behind the scenes, Denise was struggling. After Ansley's birth, she experienced postpartum depression, a condition that left her feeling overwhelmed, anxious, and disconnected. Denise's behavior became increasingly erratic, and her once meticulous control over her life and relationships started to slip. Mike tried to support her, but the strain on their marriage grew. Mike worked more, and Denise retreated more into her alternate life. And for the first time, outsiders were clued in to the couple's not-so-perfect marriage. Mike began telling his mom, Cheryl, that he was stressed. He was working late and coming home in time to make dinner and hold his daughter before going back to work. And when he couldn't go back to work, he would work from home on his computer. And although things were strained, the couple continued adding puzzle pieces to complete the perfect picture. Steve Epstein tells us more.
Mike was one of the hardest worker Clay Ketchum, his boss, had ever seen, to the point that his 16-hour days and working on the weekends got just infuriated Clay, his boss. His boss eventually had to take his keys away from him because he was such a hard worker. And he did everything at home, too. Denise was doing nothing for their 19-month-old. Instead, Mike would take care of her. He would bring her to the office and work until 1, 2 a.m. And he would rock her with his foot in her baby seat from the car. And Mike did it all. He did 100% at home. He did 100% at work. He did very well for himself. He wanted to have better financial circumstances for himself and for his wife. The home that they moved into, which I've been to, a beautiful home in a beautiful subdivision that they bought shortly after Ansley was born, with 100% his hard-earned money.
On August 31st, 1999, Mike and Denise purchased a two-story, three-bedroom home in the upscale Centennial Oak Circle. And with that, Mike also decided, with the help of his best friend Brian, to up his life insurance policy to $1.25 million. Mike's goal in life was to take care of his family. The stress of losing his dad, worrying about his mom, and Denise's vulnerable emotional state was wearing on him. He was struggling, and of course, he confided this in his best friend, Brian, because if you can't tell your best friend, well, who can you tell?
Mike found comfort in his work and the mentorship of his boss, Clay Ketchum. One day, in a rare moment of vulnerability, Mike confided in Clay about the struggles he was facing at home. He expressed his deep concern over Denise's inability to care for Ansley properly, attributing it to her ongoing battle with postpartum depression. Mike also revealed that their intimate relationship had suffered significantly, with Denise showing little interest in physical affection. More alarming than that, Mike also told Clay that Denise withdrew $3,000 without telling Mike. And when he confronted her, she told him she took the money and bought marijuana. He also revealed that while on a work trip, and by the way, one that Denise was invited to attend but declined, she left Ansley with her mom and went on a trip to Orlando with Brian and Kathy. He felt increasingly isolated and helpless, unsure how to support his wife while managing his responsibilities as a father and provider. These private conversations with Clay offered Mike a brief respite from his growing frustration and despair.
Denise's postpartum struggles, combined with her financial infidelity and emotional issues, created a perfect storm of turmoil and dissatisfaction. This period marked the beginning of the end for the Williams' seemingly perfect life, setting the stage for the tragic events that would soon unfold.
As we dive deeper into the story, it's important to understand the dynamics that were in play in Mike and Denise's marriage. Over the years, their marriage began to show signs of strain. Financial and emotional issues crept in, adding tension to their seemingly perfect life.
Denise was known to have a controlling nature, which often put Mike in a position where he had to make efforts to keep the peace. Despite these growing strains, the couple remained actively involved in their community and church. Their public image was one of dedication and commitment, especially Mike's. He was incredibly dedicated to his family and his work.
Mike's dedication was evident to anyone who knew him. He continued to excel in his career thanks to his mentor, Clay Ketchum, and his unyielding work ethic. At home, he was a loving husband and father, always putting his family first. Denise, meanwhile, played the part of the devoted wife and mother. But behind the scenes, things were beginning to unravel. The affair between Denise and Brian added yet another layer of strain to an already fragile marriage between Mike and Denise. It wasn't just an ordinary affair. It was a betrayal of the deepest kind. Mike trusted Brian like a brother, and Denise's actions were a profound breach of that trust.
While Denise and Brian were sneaking around, Mike remained blissfully unaware of the affair. He continued to work hard and maintain his involvement in the community and church, all while trying to keep his marriage intact. He had no idea that the people he trusted most were deceiving him. Meanwhile, Brian and Denise were having public sex and engaging in risky behavior. And according to Brian, they began including his wife, Kathy, into their sexual fantasies. Ignorant to their affair, Kathy found herself being recorded by Brian while engaging in sexual acts with Denise while on a trip to Panama City, Florida.
The duplicity didn't end there. Denise and Brian went to great lengths to keep their affair hidden. They were careful and calculated, aware of the stakes involved. The affair added a sinister undercurrent to the seemingly perfect lives they had all built together.
It's heartbreaking to think about Mike's dedication and trust in those around him, only to be betrayed by the very people he held closest. The stage was set for a tragedy, and the unraveling of these relationships would lead to a series of events that no one could have foreseen.
This tangled web of relationships and deceit set the scene for what was to come. As the cracks in Mike and Denise's marriage widened, leading to an unimaginable and tragic conclusion.
These are the events leading up to Mike Williams' disappearance. The story is just beginning to unfold, and the twists and turns are far from over.
In early 2000, and according to Brian, the pressure around Denise and Mike was building to a fever pitch. Brian and Denise were having a torrid affair and Mike was clueless. He knew something was wrong in his marriage, but he never suspected his best friend would betray him. But his best friend, whom he gave complete access to his life to, was betraying him in ways that were unfathomable. Brian and Denise's sexual affair had spanned years. But on this day, December 16, 2000, Mike Williams was a happy man. He had convinced Denise to go away with him overnight to the Gibson Inn in Apalachicola, Florida. It's a beautiful hotel on the water, and the two of them were going to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary. Just the two of them. Denise's sister Deanna had agreed to watch the baby so Denise and Mike could try to reconnect and hopefully rekindle the romance between them. Ansley was 18 months old, and it had been a rough couple of years adjusting to parenthood. Denise had seemed to lose all interest in Mike since Ansley was born, and he was hoping that this night would change that. And adding to his excitement was the fact that Denise had actually suggested that he go duck hunting that morning before they left. Mike was in heaven. He assured her he would be back by 1 o'clock. The plan was to be on the road by 2 o'clock and check into the hotel with plenty of time to enjoy the day by the water. Just the two of them. Early that morning, at 3 a.m., Mike woke up in the guest bedroom of his beautiful suburban home. Not wanting to wake Denise and the baby up, he decided the guest bedroom was the smartest choice. Decked in his camo, he loaded his Ford Bronco up with his life jacket, paddle, decoys, anchor, and of course, his waders. He made a special note of bringing his waders on that day. Mike hitched his boat and trailer to the back of his truck and rolled out of the driveway, heading out into the chilly morning air. The beautiful sound of stillness that he so loved, when everyone was sleeping and the only sounds were those coming from his truck tires crushing the gravel on the empty moonlit road. It was 4 a.m. when he pulled into his office at Ketchum Appraisal. After Ansley's birth, Mike had started storing his guns in the case at work as a safety precaution. He quickly disarmed the security system and hurried upstairs to the safe. There, Mike grabbed his shotgun from the gun case and headed back down the staircase and out the door. By 4:03, Mike was on the road and headed to a special spot on Lake Seminole, about 1 hour away. At around 2 p.m., Denise was pacing and questioning what she should do. Mike was not home and had not called. He promised to be home by 1 o'clock, and she was now in a panic. Nervously, she picked up the phone and called her sister, Deanna, who was expecting Ansley to be dropped off any minute. Instead, Deanna was alarmed when she heard the panic in her sister's voice when she explained that Mike had not come home. Deanna immediately drove to Denise's and the two ladies called their father. When Mike still had not arrived at home, a call was placed to friends and family and the FWC. That afternoon, Brian Winchester was about 1 hour away in Cairo, Georgia, with his wife, Kathy, at her family's holiday party. On his way home, Brian was surprised when his dad reached out with the news that Mike had not come home from hunting that day, and there were already people searching for him. Feeling the situation was urgent, Brian and his dad borrowed a boat and immediately headed to Lake Seminole. Mike was considered family, and if he needed help, they were going to give it. As nightfall moved in and the initial search party moved out, it seemed that Mike had simply vanished. But at 2:30 a.m. on December 17, Mike's boat was found drifting aimlessly on the lake by none other than Brian Winchester and his father. His Ford Bronco and boat trailer were also discovered nearby. By sunup on December 17, everyone in the community of Tallahassee and Lake Seminole were aware of Mike's disappearance.
The investigation into Mike's disappearance would prove to be anything but straightforward, marked by twists and turns that no one could have anticipated. The serene waters of Lake Seminole hid a dark secret, and as the search for answers continued, the community would be drawn into a web of deceit and betrayal that stretched far beyond that fateful December morning. That concludes part one of the Mike Williams case. Be sure to join us for part two and the shocking conclusion, where we dive into the detailed confession that left family, friends, and investigators stunned. You won't want to miss the twists and revelations that finally brought justice to this case. Like us on Facebook at Cold Case Playing Cards for all the latest information on this case and other cards we'll be featuring on future episodes. Healing Justice is written, produced, and hosted by Jennifer Dubisak and myself, Lori Jennings. Our executive consultant is the Cold Case Playing Cards creator, retired FDLE Special Agent Tommy Ray. If you want to help us spread the word about these victims' stories, please subscribe and leave us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. And tell your friends to subscribe.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.